The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video stream of this show every weekday morning at 11:05 a.m. in the central time zone of the United States. Just go to trumpetdaily.com or visit our Rumble channel, rumble.com/trumpetdaily. If you go to Rumble, make sure you give us the thumbs up and leave a nice comment. You can also email the show at td@thetrumpet.com. So we are here. We're still in southeast Oklahoma, just off the Wichita Mountains. Beautiful camp out for the boys the first day and a half, and then now the girls. And coming up on today's show, the bulk of today's show will be the girls forum, a more excellent way of life. That's what I titled that forum that I gave earlier this morning out at the camp out. So that will take up the second segment, almost 40 minutes worth for a Bible study to finish with today's show. But for the first segment here, just a little bit of time to concentrate on three pretty big speeches. You have the fake president in the Oval Office address last night saying that he's going to bow out and leave the presidency to the oncoming generation, a younger generation. And then you also have President Trump. For his part, he's out on the campaign trail. He continues to speak. He continues to speak boldly. He continues to lead far and away in the polls. And then also you've got a powerful speech delivered by Benjamin Netanyahu. He spoke in Congress yesterday. Truly a Lion of Judah type speech, as he brought to mind some fairly recent history, comparing, as we did back at the time, comparing the tragedy, the atrocities of October 7 to 9/11 for here in America. As Bibi pointed out yesterday, I mean, their October 7 is like 20 9/11s. If you just look at the population size of little Israel compared to the United States. Let me just play a clip from Bibi's speech yesterday in Congress.
Ladies and gentlemen, like December 7th, 1941, and September 11th, 2001, October 7th is a day that will forever live in infamy. It was the Jewish holiday of Simchat Torah. It began as a perfect day, not a cloud in the sky. Thousands of young Israelis were celebrating at an outdoor music festival. And suddenly, at 6:29 a.m., as children were still sleeping soundly in their beds in the towns and kibbutzim next to Gaza, suddenly heaven turned into hell. 3,000 Hamas terrorists stormed into Israel. They butchered 1,200 people from 41 countries, including 39 Americans. Proportionately, compared to our population size, that's like 20 9/11s in one day. And these monsters, they raped women, they beheaded men, they burnt babies alive, they killed parents in front of their children, and children in front of their parents. They dragged 255 people, both living and dead, into the dark dungeons of Gaza. Israel has already brought home 135 of these hostages, including 7 who were freed in daring rescue operations.
Sundance had this to say about Bibi's address. He wrote, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu delivered a strong speech to a joint session of the U.S. Congress earlier today. That would be yesterday. The main thrust of PM Netanyahu's speech was about Israel's ongoing effort to fight back against Hamas terrorists in Gaza. Now, following the speech, Nancy Pelosi said it was the, what did she say, the worst speech ever given in Congress. So there you go. They hate it. They hate it when an Israeli prime minister comes in and actually stands up for the Jewish people and talks about that brotherly alliance that should be there between little Judah and, of course, Manasseh, brother nations. But there's Nancy Pelosi quick to criticize what was just a little bit of recent history for both of our nations coming under attack from terrorists. Who's going to rise and answer back to these kinds of attacks? Who will have the courage? I mean, Bibi, at his address, it shows that he's really the only one for Israel at this time in its history. As I said, the day, yesterday that is, a lot of notable speeches. Bibi's, as you just heard there, and also Joe Biden, as he labored through an Oval Office address, lying multiple times and finding it difficult to just get through the occasion. Here's a clip from Joe Biden's address last night.
You know, in recent weeks, it's become clear to me that I need to unite my party in this critical endeavor. I believe my record as president, my leadership in the world, my vision for America's future, all merited a second term, but nothing, nothing can come in the way of saving our democracy. That includes personal ambition. So I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
Here again, Sundance made some interesting points at Conservative Treehouse, saying that it looked like Biden had some kind of, or maybe multiple injuries on his face. So as you know, he basically went off with the COVID, had disappeared for a number of days, sends out the tweet on Sunday saying that he's not going to run for re-election. And then finally, he speaks to the nation last night, and there you heard it. This is from PJ Media, where it says, Joe Biden's speech from the Oval Office was so chock full of outrageous lies and slurred gaffes, it's hard to know where to start when fact-checking and dissecting it. It says, but one thing is certain, when NBC called it a speech for the history books, they were spreading even faker news than usual. Imagine that. Biden gives his address, NBC says, this is for the history books. Bibi goes in and gives that powerful address before Congress, and Pelosi says it's the worst ever inside those chambers. Pretty amazing. Well, as I say, Trump was also out on the campaign trail. We've got a clip coming from him in just a second. But just to go back to the Obama Biden split, I mentioned, I think it was yesterday or the day before, how that Biden came out with the announcement Sunday, but then just 30 minutes after he said he's not going to run for re-election, he endorses Kamala Harris. And it was, I mean, not long after that, that all the Democrats got right in line. Everyone except for the dear leader, they got right in line showing their support for Kamala Harris. This is from Fox News. It says a list of former President Obama's allies. Well, this article basically just talks about how Obama had a hand in shoving Biden aside. But then after that, again, it's interesting, given what is mentioned there in Amos 7, given how Obama's influence is going to be diminished. This is from the New York Post. It says former President Barack Obama hasn't endorsed Kamala Harris's presidential bid because he doesn't think she can beat Donald Trump, according to a source close to the Biden family. So again, very revealing. Obama, the dear leader, he doesn't think Kamala can win either. And that's all that this is about. They've got to win. They've got to maintain their grip on power. It says, following President Biden's shocking exit from the race on Sunday and his immediate endorsement of the vice president, most of the Democratic elite have been quick to rally behind Harris. But Obama is a notable exception. Obama's very upset because he knows she can't win, the Biden family source told the Post. He's upset. So here, it may have been Biden on his way out, you know, kicking Obama in the back, stabbing Obama in the back, saying that, hey, let's get behind Kamala. Now, the clip I have from Donald Trump a little bit later. He's out on the campaign trail saying they'll try Kamala out for a little bit. And then actually, that's not in the clip that I have, but I saw another one earlier today where he said that, you know, they'll try her out a little bit. If it doesn't work after a few weeks, they'll throw her under the bus and get a third candidate. We'll see if Trump's right about that. This is from Axios, though. President Biden hesitated to drop his reelection campaign in part because he and his senior advisors worried that Vice President Harris wasn't up to taking on Donald Trump. So you hear all of this fakery and phoniness, as I said yesterday on the show. Everyone saying, oh, yeah, Kamala Harris, she's leading in that Reuters poll, 44-42. And yet behind closed doors, Obama doesn't think she can win. And even Biden's team, this is why Biden stayed in as long as he did, evidently. This is what, at least what Axios is reporting. I had this clip from a number of days ago from Jesse Waters, where it's the sit down that he had with Donald Trump. And he talked about just how Obama has come after Trump or has tried to plot against Donald Trump. Let's play that, clip five.
Obama's still plotting against you, trying to take you out.
They got some big problems over there. First of all, Obama hates Biden, and Biden hates Obama. And when Obama walked Biden out a couple of weeks ago off the stage, he didn't have to do that. He could have let him wave to the people a little bit longer. I don't know if Joe knew who he was waving to, but he was waving. And all of a sudden, Obama comes along, grabs him. Come on, Joe. Like he was a child. It made him look so bad. And I know people with Biden. I know people with Obama. And they were not happy about that. It made him look really bad, like a child. Like a child. They don't like each other. And I think that it's pretty tough. This guy got, what, 14, 15 million votes? Delegates, he had the votes. So he goes through a process. He gets them. And the whole thing has been a con. Look, when they kept him in the basement in the first, those people should be looked at because they lied to the American public.
So there's Donald Trump pointing out this obvious divide that exists between the Obama team and Biden. I had one more clip. I just won't have the time here to play it. But it was Trump out on the campaign trail basically saying, you know, people have said I'm supposed to be a nice guy now after the assassination attempt. But look at the people that I'm dealing with here. You can't play nice with these kinds of vile, vicious people who hate America and want to see it fundamentally transformed. So that's all. Sadly, that's all that we have time for in our news segment because the Bible study segment runs a little bit longer than usual. When we come back, we'll get you to the forum that we had for the girl campers earlier today, a more excellent way of life. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
What has happened to the United States of America? The wealthiest, most powerful nation in human history is suddenly divided, weakened, radical. The evil in America has grown powerful. The good has grown weak. The honorable parts of American history are succumbing to a direct, targeted, sustained assault. Someone, something is dismantling America's history, purpose, and character.
Fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
Political dysfunction, social strife, economic peril, catastrophic moral failure, fires, attacks, riots, lies. The nation is being attacked from within by its own leaders. Powerful elites in government, journalism, academia, and beyond are intentionally, rapidly destroying what America is in order to make it into something else. There is a reason why your nation is crumbling before your eyes. There is a spirit and a specific perpetrator that is attempting to blot out America. Only America Under Attack reveals that perpetrator and the motive and spirit behind him. This newly expanded book shows you the reason why America has changed so dramatically, so suddenly. If you're confused and concerned about what is happening to America, request your free copy of America Under Attack by Gerald Fleury at thetrumpet.com.
Welcome to our lovely ladies at this back half of the outdoor camp out here in the Wichita Mountains, southeast Oklahoma. As you ladies know, this year's theme for SEP has been A More Excellent Way, which is based on what Paul wrote at the end of 1 Corinthians 12. And if you look around at the world today, they're not striving for any form of godly excellence. There may be an occasional exception here and there, but for the most part, the world is this, they're just doing what seems right in their own eyes. They're not looking to God for his standard of excellence. And you could just look at world events and, you know, we have the trumpet daily. It goes out every day. And every day in that first segment, you see that we're certainly living in a world that is not God's world. It's Satan's world, and many scriptures bring this out, and yet it's rarely talked about in the world of traditional Christianity. The reason why Jesus told us to come out of this world is exactly that, because the devil is this world's god, 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. So Christ said, I have chosen you out of the world. That's in John 15. Yesterday on the program, I went through 2 Corinthians 6, the last few verses, which speak also of coming out of this world and being separate from the world. I enjoyed the fireside discussion last night, by the way, but I think one answer that didn't come up when, you know, why would God bring us out here and there's no, you know, there's no internet service, their phones don't work, you know, it's pretty primitive. There's, you know, longhorns that roam the campus in the middle of the night. But I think one benefit to doing things like this is you literally are coming out of the world. I mean, the world is not around us. This is just our camp, you know, God's people striving to live a more excellent way. And there's a lot to be said for, we can't do this, you know, all year long, but there's a lot to be said for simplifying our lives so that we can really put the focus on the excellent way like we should. Galatians 1 and verse 4, I'll just throw a lot of verses at you, but that verse talks about this present evil world. God, that's God's assessment of this world. And it's not like there is no hope. I mean, Mr. Armstrong in Mystery of the Ages lays it out there. There's a time order to this plan of salvation. And God would have all men to be saved, it says in the New Testament. So he has a plan, and most people, when it's all said and done, are going to be saved, are going to be born into God's family. That's awesome when you think of it. But when you look at the world today, or this age, as it could be translated in Revelation 12:9 and other passages, this age is about to end. And there's a new age, a new world, a new civilization that's about to start. And that's what you ladies are a part of. This is the beginning of God's civilization. It's a mustard seed beginning. But if you look at the ministry of Jesus Christ, I mean, he had, 12 disciples that he worked with primarily. And I know his ministry attracted large crowds, largely because of the miracles that he performed. But when you get to the end of it, I think it's Acts 1 and verse 15, it says that Peter was there among 120 disciples. That's all. After 3.5 years, and he was working with those disciples, those 12, he was telling them the meaning behind all those parables that he spoke in. And then, you know, he's crucified, he's resurrected from the dead. And it says in the first chapter of Acts that there were 120 disciples at that time. Now, it did grow rapidly in those first few chapters of Acts, Acts 2, Acts 3, Acts 4, but thousands were coming into the church. But as soon as that rapid growth started, intense persecution set in. The devil went after God's flock. It was a little flock, and it was scattered abroad. because of that persecution. In many cases, a violent persecution. And that's the way it's been for God's people ever since. 2,000 years of it. You can read more on that with our booklet, The True History of God's True Church. But that work, that mustard seed beginning, it never did die. There were seven church eras, as is covered in Revelation 2 and 3. And here we are in the seventh and final era of God's church. And here again, it's just a little flock that's doing God's work today. We've seen how that 95% of God's people have just drifted away from God in the Laodicean rebellion, and they've gone back into the world. They've gone back into darkness. John 3 and verse 19 says that Jesus came to this world as the light, but mankind loved darkness. That's what this world has chosen. And of course, we all know what they did to Jesus Christ. They persecuted him. They crucified him. They chased after him. That was a violent persecution. Some of us were talking the other day about unjust courts that we see in the land today, but it's not like that's unusual. It's not like that's unique to our time. I mean, you go back to the trial, the kangaroo court that led to Jesus Christ's crucifixion, or the persecution that got the Apostle Paul beheaded. There have been corrupt, unjust judges and attorneys for centuries, for thousands of years. That's just been man's way. That's human nature. To violently persecute and to go after God's people. Even still, though, be assured that when Christ came in the flesh, even though he was crucified after a 3.5-year ministry, he started something new that this world has never seen. He started something entirely different from the world that we now live in, the world that we see all around us. He started a brand new civilization. And as I say, it started with just a handful of disciples. And as you know, a disciple means student. So they were trained, these disciples. And even then, there was one of them that was corrupt, that went after Jesus Christ in the end. And that happens from time to time in this spiritual war. But that was the beginning, the mustard seed beginning of a new civilization that is God's family. Acts chapter 19, and we could just look at a few verses that talk about this way of life, that it is the excellent way, but it has brought a lot of persecution onto God's people because, like John 3:19 says, because men love darkness. And there's other verses that talk about, you know, if you live righteously in these last days, that you're going to make yourself a prey or a target. We certainly have to be wise and not bring it upon ourselves unnecessarily. But if we're out there letting our light shine, like Matthew 5 says that we should, then there's going to be some from time to time who don't like it, who they don't like God's law. There's just a built-in hostility, like it says in Romans 8 and verse 7. Human nature is hostile to God and to his law. They're hostile to the guidebook that is the Holy Bible. There's a built-in hostility toward God's commandments. We don't want to live according to that excellent way. We don't want to submit to God's authority. We don't want to obey the commandments of God. And God says, okay, I'm going to have, for the most part, a hands-off policy for 6,000 years, and we'll let you go your way, and we'll let you try your ideas with respect to education and industry and commerce and business, with respect to education, all those things. And look at where we are, 6,000 years in to this purpose and plan. If you look at the Bible and its teaching, it's so plain that Christianity is just simply a wonderful way of life. It's living the way of give. It's living the way of unselfish, outflowing concern for others. And as I say, you don't see a lot of that in this world today. But that's the way of a Christian. A Christian is a follower of Christ. Jesus Christ was perfect. Jesus Christ obeyed the commandments. Jesus Christ lived the way of love. Jesus Christ sacrificed his life. And so that's the example that we follow, or at least that we're striving to. It's a process. It's a lifelong process at that. But God has given us so much instruction. And then now, in a lot of ways, you could say that you at this camp, you're in training. You're receiving training as disciples of Christ. You're learning about a more excellent way. And that way brings blessings and peace and prosperity into our lives. Even if we're persecuted from time to time, you still can have inner peace and love. You still can go forward unfazed by the devil's attacks. We're all going to have to just be a little bit tougher as we go forward. That was another thought that came to mind last night as you were talking about, well, why would we, given the role that God has in mind for a young lady, why would we want them to immerse themselves into a lot of strenuous physical activity with sports and rappelling and other activities that you enjoy here at camp? And obviously, you don't want to step outside of your role and attitude, like some of you said last night, and maintaining an attitude of meekness and being submissive and that sort of thing. That all still applies. But at the same time, I mean, for a godly woman to thrive in the church today in these last days, she's going to have to be tough. She's going to have some strength in more ways than one, mentally, spiritually, physically. And so these are good exercises to just learn how to push yourself physically. There's some carryover into pushing yourself mentally and spiritually as well. We've all been hearing about the 7 laws of success, and we all need to drive ourselves forward. Acts 19 and verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass that while Apollos was at Corinth, Paul, having passed through the upper coasts, came to Ephesus, and finding certain disciples, there's a few here and there. And you know how Paul just traveled around from one place to the next. Sometimes he'd stop in Corinth for 18 months. Other times he'd stop in Athens and stay there for just a couple of days because there were no people. There were no disciples. Nobody was interested. And then he moved on and God was leading him. And God told him when he was praying in Corinth, no, because he was prepared to leave pretty quick from there too. And God said, no, I want you to stay here. There's a lot of work to be done here. There's a lot of potential disciples. There's a lot of prospective members. And Paul complied. Verse 9, skip down, it says, "But when divers were hardened and believed not, but spoke evil of that way before the multitude, he departed from them and separated the disciples, disputing daily in the school of one Tyrannus." So he, you know, Jesus said in Matthew 10, go from one city to the next, and if they persecute you, get up, dust yourself off, go to the next city. And that's the approach that Paul took. These people, these persecutors, were speaking evil of that way, the more excellent way. They hated it. They despised it. They fought against it. And Paul was not deterred. I mean, he moved on and he started a school. That's awesome to think about the Spirit. It would be so easy to just get negative and critical and discouraged and give up and think that, well, it's just too hard. It's too hard to go forward. Verse 23, I'm just hitting the high spots for lack of time, but verse 23 says, and the same time there arose no small stir about that way. It does turn the world upside down. That's what some of the so-called witnesses said when Paul was on trial. This guy is a heretic. I mean, he's turning the world upside down. That's the way of God. That's the way the world, for the most part, reacts to God's way of life. Some of them, from time to time, when they see the fruits that come from it, you know, let's say family members who aren't in the church, but they see, okay, you know, they didn't like it at the start when, let's say, a member got married to another member in the church. But then years on, you know, when they see the fruits, the family, the children, and that sort of thing, then the unconverted mate begins to think, you know, that's, I don't agree with the way they do it. I don't follow the more excellent way, but, you know, I do like what it has produced in the case of my children or my whoever. Verse 23 again, no small stir, about that way. If people today would just follow this way of life, this more excellent way, they would learn how to solve family problems, marriage problems, problems with child rearing. They'd learn how to be happy and content and filled with peace. But if you're not willing to go according to this way, then you're not going to live the abundant life. Jesus spoke of that in John 10. Real abundant living. Look at Herbert Armstrong's ministry, just to use him as an example. I mean, he was persecuted, tried, tested, but he would not be stopped. He just kept going forward. I mean, he had some breaking points where he even had to repent before God that he wanted to give up. But then he would get up the next day and go forward. Speaking of, again, dealing with family problems, and there's a lot of those in this world, Mr. Armstrong wrote in 1985, he says, nothing in this material world is as important as a happy home life with father, mother, and well-taught, happy children, a close-knit family. He says, why? Because it strikes at the very heart and core of humanity's future and eternity and the gospel that Jesus Christ proclaimed. I mean, this is what we're here building. God's family, physical families, this is the foundation of a strong, stable, peaceful, happy society, a society where there's just abundance, where everyone enjoys abundance. That's what God is building. Look at how he's blessed the work. You know, you talk about a mustard seed beginning. We're about to head into our 24th year for Armstrong College. The PCG's been around for, I guess, 34 years. And look at what God has done with a handful of people that are committed to living a more excellent way. And you're here, you're part of that. And your goal and objective should be to stay as part of that. Because some over the years have decided to leave it. And it's sad to see that happen. Look at Acts chapter 18, close by. Acts 18 and verse 26. It says, and he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, they took him, this is speaking of Apollos, they took him unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly. Apollos had a lot of ability. He was a persuasive speaker, but he didn't have his full understanding of God's purpose and way yet. And Priscilla and Aquila, to their credit, they took him aside and said, here, let us update you. Let us bring you right up to speed with where God is in this training with his disciples. They were teaching him a more excellent way. They wanted to help perfect his knowledge so that he could be an even more effective teacher. That's what I spoke to the fellows about the other day, that we're called to teach. We can't just sit here and selfishly take it in. God always expects for you to use the knowledge. Use it in your own life first. Use it with, as I said to the fellows, your siblings. If you're an older sibling, I mean, what an example it is to have someone who's committed to living the more excellent way, and how tragic it is when an older sibling decides to depart from this way and set, in that sense, a terrible example. We're in the book of Acts. Look at Acts 24. Acts this is one of those trials that the Apostle Paul had to endure. As I say, there were false witnesses, unjust judges, and lawless attorneys, even in Paul's day. And in every one of these trials, I love envisioning the Apostle Paul answering his accusers. He always does it. I mean, he does it with, you know, boldness for sure. But there's just also a positive, you know, step forward attitude, as he wrote about in Hebrews 10. Acts 24 and verse 5, it says, "For we have found," this is one, I think his name's Tertullus. He's one of the false accusers. "We have found this man, Paul, a pestilent fellow." Oh no, a pestilent fellow. It says here, "and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes." I mean, this is a dirty sect. He's spreading all this seditious content, and it's dividing our nation. No, he was actually teaching the more excellent way. And the people that responded to it, their lives were transformed for the better. Verse 10, further down, it says, "Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned unto him to speak, answered, 'For as much as I know that you have been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself.'" I'll cheerfully answer that accusation. It says in verse 13, "Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me." Verse 14, "But this I confess unto you, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and the prophets." He was just a Bible-believing doer of the word of God. And Paul confessed, you know, this way of life, which they call heresy. Yeah, I confess. I do observe those ways. I do live those ways. Consider me guilty. He was not ashamed of God's truth. And toward the end of his life, he had to even tell Timothy, "Now look, Timothy, you better get some courage and strength here, because you're sounding like you're a little bit ashamed of the gospel of God." It's easy to just surrender. I mean, we see the spirit of surrender all around us in our nation, politically. I mean, it's everywhere. People that just don't want to fight against this communist invasion of the United States. They want to surrender to it. They want to make peace with it. They want to find a compromise. And with that Marxist side, they want no part of compromise. They want the revolution. Is the excellent way of God, is it worth fighting for? Is it worth taking a stand for? Absolutely it is. There is no other way except God's way. And the whole world's soon going to find that out. The way they call heresy, yes. If that's how you define a heretic, well then, I guess I'm a heretic. Verse 22 says, "And when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them and said, 'When Lysias, the chief captain, shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter.'" So he, you know, a lot of these ones that made the final decision, after the trial went and they would listen to Paul, their hearts were kind of pricked. You know, in one case, I can't remember if it's Felix or Agrippa, but one of them said, "Paul, you make me almost want to be a Christian. I mean, now I'm not going to be, but you kind of convincing me here." The other one said, "Hey, let's put this off for a little bit of a season, because I can't really accept this at this time in my life." A lot of people do that. They know it's true. I had a couple of them come up to me at one of the concerts, one of the Celtic Throne shows. I mentioned this before. But they basically were complimenting the program. They were thanking me. And they're no part of God's work or church. Very sad to see that. People that believe, but in word only, they don't believe as a doer. You have to be a doer, or else all of this knowledge is just given to you in vain. It's dangerous knowledge, Mr. Armstrong used to say. Because if you don't use it, I mean, you look at the course that this world is on, this present evil world, and you don't want to be on that train when everything crashes. Mr. Armstrong talked about God's college back in 1967. I mean, he really had a vision for what God was building and creating, this new civilization, all the way back to 1947 when he started AC. But he says here in 1967, yes, this world is going to end. The age of this civilization, or Satan's civilization, it will end. Humanity won't be totally destroyed. God's intervention will prevent it. You can see that in Matthew 24. The earth won't blow up or evaporate or cease to exist, but the world, that is, this system of society, this world's economic, social, religious, educational, and political structures are definitely going to be destroyed. They will be destroyed by the second coming of Christ. If you're listening to me, you don't hear these kinds of things in the world of traditional Christianity. You don't hear that this is Satan's world. Their idea of religion is that we've got to try to get as many people saved before it's too late. Or God's plan and purpose is sort of like a salvage and repair job. You know, Satan came along, caught God off guard, and destroyed everything almost. And then God's plan is to try to repair as much as possible. That's not God's purpose and plan at all. It represents the devil as being stronger than God. God has let this world go the way of man, not God's way, certainly not. He's let it go that way to teach a lesson that there is no hope in man. Our only hope is in God, God's way of life, God's future, God's purpose, God's plan. And if you let that God being into your life, I mean, everything changes for the better. If you're striving for excellence, you will experience abundance and peace and happiness and joy. It says, but a totally new world will shine forth. Jesus Christ, with all the divine power and glory of the eternal God, will return to earth to set up the world-ruling kingdom of God. The world tomorrow will be God's world. We are now at the end of man's world. You young ladies, I mean, you're going to be blessed to transition, I mean, even in the physical sense, from man's world into God's world. And people are going to be asking you, talking to you for all eternity about the times that you lived in, seeing all this prophecy being fulfilled right here at the end of man's age, and then the transition right on through the Great Tribulation, the Day of the Lord, and then the return of Jesus Christ to this earth and the establishment of God's kingdom on this earth. When everyone, all children are going to be going to SEPs, they're all going to be attending IA, they're all going to be attending God's college, they're all going to be receiving training as disciples of Christ, students. We do have to be trained in this way. We do need, you see how important education is in everything we're talking about at this camp. It says, we are now at the end of man's world, but here, even now, is the herald of the peaceful world tomorrow. Already in existence are two of the New World educational institutions. This man had some vision, Herbert Armstrong. He was looking at AC going, this is the beginning. This is the beginning of a new civilization. He was saying that at a time when AC probably had like 100 students. Really? Critics would have just howled in laughter. Are you serious? You think this is the beginning of a new civilization? Yes, it is. Those that would dare criticize him, well, what would they say about Jesus Christ, you know, withdrawing from the crowd with just 12 people and saying, now listen, I'm speaking in parables over here to the crowds because it's not given for them to know yet. It's not their time. But you, on the other hand, You know. Here, let me give you the meaning of these parables. We've seen so much growth and development over the years, even in the midst of the Laodicean rebellion, where, Armstrong, or rather Ambassador College closed down. Most of God's people fell away from the truth. But then here comes God, as it says in Amos 9, just raising the ruins. And he's doing it with just a fraction of the people that were there supporting Mr. Armstrong during his ministry. It's a miracle. What you're seeing at the campus in particular, but in the worldwide work that God's church is doing, it's a miracle. It's a total miracle from God. And it's the beginning of a new civilization. A few more scriptures, Hebrews 10. The church has so many youth programs because Mr. Armstrong said himself that the most important group that we can reach is the young people. You're the ones receiving the training the earliest. You're the ones being grounded in the truth, from your birth in some cases, in most cases, growing up in God's way of life, growing up in the midst of a more excellent way. And yet the devil can get to you. And you can begin to resent that, like you've been somehow shut off or deprived from everything that's out there in this world. And so some have decided, well, let's just go out and immerse ourselves into the world. Something that's straight out of the prodigal son. And then they learn right away. And you can see it on their faces when you meet them. You can see it on their skin with all the tattoos. You can see it with their styles. You can see it with the people they hang out with. And you can immerse yourself into materialism. There is, like Hebrews 11 says, there's a short-term thrill to sinning, but there's always a boomerang. It always comes back. It always comes back on you. And then the suffering sets in. And then the misery, the unhappiness. Why would you want to choose that course, that way, when here you are receiving the more excellent way? Hebrews 10. It says in verse 19, having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way. Look at how many scriptures there are that talk about this new way of life. Even Jesus at that final Passover in John 13, he says, I've shown you a new way. And he was talking about God's love. It's not like God's love didn't exist, but Jesus came and actually demonstrated it perfectly, and the world had never seen it. And in fact, the world, when he came into their presence, as John 3 says, the world wouldn't accept the light because they love darkness. They love dwelling in darkness. That's the way of this world. We're learning a new and living way, which he has consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. God has set apart this way of life for us. I'll give you a proverb. You can just look at it later. It's Proverbs 23 and verse 19, where it says, hear you, my son, and be wise, and guide your heart in the way. Guide your heart. You have a part in the training yourself. This is where your, personal study and prayer comes in. This is why it's so important to organize your morning, your day, the way that it should be, so that you can just put a priority on this way of life and really work at it and really work at God's way of living. Don't just be a Christian in name only. Don't be a fake Christian. Put your heart into it. Prove God. Prove that abundance and happiness and joy comes from this way of living. Mr. Armstrong wrote this back in 1969. He said here, this new convert, he's talking about the newly begotten into the church, someone that's repented and in faith gone before God's ministry and gotten baptized and then received the Spirit of God. And then he talks about the process after that. He says here, this new convert has now repented in his mind from the depths of his heart. He means it too. In all sincerity, in his mind and heart, He has turned around to go the other way. He is, it's like he said, walking down an aisle in a theater and then just making an abrupt turn, 180 degrees, and going back and walking the other way. It says here, to live a different life. He's now a Christian. He's received the Holy Spirit. He's been converted. He's a Christian. He really wants to do what is right, to obey God, to live God's way. But listen to this. Yet he finds he does not do this perfectly. Many at this stage become discouraged. Some give up even trying to live the Christian way. And why? Because of the false notion that a Christian is one who becomes perfect at one fell swoop, or that one cannot become a Christian until he has broken all wrong habits and made himself righteous. He said it's vital to understand how true Christianity really works. The newly begotten Christian must grow up spiritually. It's a process. There was an old correspondence course lesson, the one from back in the 1960s, that had the title, Salvation is Education. It's a lifelong journey of overcoming, of growing, of furthering your education. It's not an education that's just limited to, you know, a four-year stint at AC. It's a lifelong endeavor. It's a lifelong journey, I should say. 1 Corinthians 12, we'll conclude over here. What a blessing it is to learn God's way of life, to live His lifestyle, to follow in the steps of Christ. If you follow the steps of Christ, He will lead you to glory. He will lead you to the promised land in so many ways, in more ways than one. 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 29, this is the chapter that speaks about the organization of God's church and all the members being placed where God sees fit. It's it's one body. It's one family. Christ, you can read earlier in the chapter, He's the head. He's the guide. Verse 29, it says, are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers, are all workers of miracles? Have all the gifts of healing? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? I mean, we all have different abilities, different responsibilities, but God brings you into this. God has high hopes for you, all of you, not just the ones who maybe can play the piano or sing or dance or whatever, but He really wants for you to develop your talents, your abilities. He wants you to be academically inclined. He wants you to fulfill your role. He wants you to be not just, you know, a good wife and mother. He wants you to be an excellent one. A more excellent way. Verse 31, it says, but wherever you are in the body, whatever member you are of the body of Christ, He says, covet earnestly the best gifts. And yet show I unto you a more excellent way. And then that leads in perfectly to the next chapter, which is the love chapter. Covet that. Earnestly desire God's love, living the way of God's love, and then be committed as you go away from camp here in just a few days now to live it. To live it and then to give it to as many others as possible.